Okay, well, let's go ahead and open up to Genesis chapter 16. I wanted to kind of reiterate what Gary said as well, that the memorial service for Gail last week, or on Friday, was awesome. The gospel was so well presented. It was weaved in so well. Personal stories were weaved in so well. So just a great blessing to everybody who was there. Genesis chapter 16, just kind of reviewing a little bit, Genesis chapter 15. Again, chapter 15 really stands as probably one of the most pivotal chapters in all the Bible. You know, again, reviewing what we looked at last week, God addresses Abram's fear. He clarifies, God clarifies his promise to Abram and binds himself to Abram and the promises he makes him through this dramatic ancient covenant ritual. And God assures Abram that he will be Abram's shield and very great reward. And he addresses Abram's, kind of has that lingering concern, yeah, you're promising me posterity, but I don't have a child yet. So then God addresses that issue. And he, again, remember, Abram was talking about how, I guess, Eliezer, my a slave guy, is going to have to be my posterity, is going to have to be my heir. And God says, no, it's going to be someone from your own body. Just be patient and wait until that occurs. And it's still another, you know, 15 plus years until Isaac is actually born. Again, God takes Abram outside and look up at the stars. We were looking at the stars last night, and they were awesome. And it's like that's representative of the number of posterity that you're going to have is the stars. You can't count them. Again, just the numberless posterity, vast number of descendants. And then verse 6, of course, we spent quite a bit of time on because chapter 15 is a pivotal chapter, but verse 6 of chapter 15 is probably a key verse in the Bible. If you're going to, what's the most important verse in the Bible? Well, there's a lot of them, but verse 6 of chapter 15 really stands out. This is the first time that the truth is clearly taught that justification comes strictly on the basis of God's grace by faith. Okay, that's very clearly. It has nothing to do with works. And when you stop and you think about, you know, the confusion that exists in the world today among people who would profess to be followers of God or Christians, what's the one issue that stumps everybody? They think they have to do something. They think that they have to do this or do that to be reconciled to God. But it has nothing to do with us. It has everything to do with God. Kind of remember that it's, again, back in verse 6, then he, Abram, believed in Yahweh, and he counted it to him as righteousness. We talked about how that word accounted is an accounting term. Okay, and really kind of the picture here is that God made a deposit into Abram's account. And that deposit was righteousness. Abram had no righteousness of his own to deposit into that account. God alone did it and declared Abram righteous, justified him. He was justified because of God's action. So then God, after verse 7 and following, God then reaffirms his intention to give Abram the land of Canaan. He kind of addressed the seed. No, it's not going to be Eliezer, your servant, that's going to be your heir. You're going to have a child, a son. And also, too, you are going to possess all this land. Your posterity will possess all this land, your descendants. And he encourages Abram with that truth by going through the covenant ceremony. And we looked at that last week, kind of the practice of the day. You take the animals, you cut them in half, you make a pathway, and then both parties to the agreement walk through. Joked a little bit, you know, about how we're glad we don't have to do that today when we go see our lawyer. He's not out chopping cattle in half so we can walk through and make an agreement. We just sign a paper and that works well. But this ceremony goes on, but something happens during the ceremony. Abram's sleeping, and so God walks through the cut pieces of meat, the pieces of meat, by himself. And that's very important because that signifies that God himself has obligated himself to fulfill this covenant, this promise, this agreement. It has nothing to do with Abram. He didn't walk through the pieces of meat. God alone has taken responsibility to fulfill the promises he has made. And kind of in the midst of all this too, we have a little aside about prediction of the future Egyptian bondage comes in there. It's going to last 400 years. And then God will lead them out of Egypt back to Canaan. And so that's kind of where we left off last week. We'll go ahead and pick up now in chapter 16. And in chapter 16, we learn how Abram and Sarah try to help God overcome the dilemma that they're facing of being childless. Okay, they're beyond childbearing years, the normal childbearing years, and an heir was necessary to fulfill the covenant, the promise that had been made. So they come up with an alternative plan, or Sarah in particular, comes up with an alternative plan to produce an heir. So let's go ahead and pick up with verse 1. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. Came back in chapter 11, verse 30. We saw, you know, Sarai is barren. And she had an Egyptian servant woman whose name was Hagar. Okay, so this continuing barrenness, and they're beyond childbearing years, and we're introduced now to this servant woman or maid or servant, depending on the translation that you have. And probably remember where Abram was at back in chapter 12. Where did he go when the famine hit? He went down to Egypt. Remember, then we had the fiasco where he told the Pharaoh that Sarai was his sister. And so all that mess happened. Well, then when Pharaoh found out the truth and Abram was expelled, he got to keep the servants he had collected in Egypt. So probably one of those was probably Hagar. So kind of the failure in chapter 12 is going to kind of contribute to this coming failure in chapter 16. So verse 2. So Sarai said to Abram, "Now behold, Yahweh has shut my womb from bearing children. Please go into my servant woman. Perhaps I will obtain children through her." And Abram listened to the voice of Sarai. And after Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Abram's wife Sarai took Hagar the Egyptian, her servant woman, and gave her to her husband Abram as his wife. A little awkward situation here. So again, there's the problem, and again, Sarai and comes up with this ill-conceived plan, this human solution to share her husband with another woman as the only solution to producing the heir God had promised. Okay, so in the last chapter, it's got to be Eleazar, our slave, that's going to be the heir. Well, no, now it's going to be somebody through this Egyptian slave servant woman, Hagar. So again, they abandon faith. Is really kind of the key point here. You know, you kind of contrast that with what is actually going to happen, you know, another 15 years from here in the future. There's going to be a miraculous conception, and Hagar, or Sarai, is going to give birth to Isaac. So again, some issues in these two verses. The first one is, you know, Sarai's blaming God for the fact that she can't have any children. And she's assuming it was an irreversible condition, you know, given her advanced age. And then secondly, Abram listened to his wife when he shouldn't have. And does that remind you of somebody else? Maybe back in Genesis chapter 3, like Adam went ahead and took the fruit and ate it. So again, here Abram's failing in his responsibilities here. So faith would have taken these two in a different way. God does things on his time schedule, not on man's. Okay, and he said he's going to do it, then he's going to do it. And lots of times when we try to help him out with human planning, it doesn't go so well. So what happens here is they turn to a social custom of the day. Just like they did with Eleazar, it was a social custom that if you didn't have any heir, that you could adopt your servant, and that would become your heir. That was a practice of the day. And in the same way, this is another practice of the day. If you were in need of an heir and the wife was childless, you could bring in somebody else to become sort of a substitute wife to bear a child. So again, they again adopt a, you know, it's kind of a social custom practiced in that day in the ancient Near East. Again, it was a practice of the day, but it wasn't God's plan. And as a result of their action, there's going to be a lot of hardship and difficulty that continues down to this day because, you know, the son of Abram and Hagar is Ishmael. Well, who derives from the Ishmaelites? The Arabs. So do the Arabs and Jews, the children of Isaac, love each other? No, it's been constant conflict for thousands of years, and this is where it all kind of started. So again, the impact of this compromise with the culture. I thought it was also interesting that Abram becomes the first godly man to be a practicing polygamist. Now, we're going to see that practice unfold as time goes on, even in Genesis. But it puts him in the company with godless Lamech back in chapter 4, the descendant of godless Cain. So again, God's plan has always been one man, one woman, and a permanent relationship. That was, you know, back in Genesis chapter 2, verse 18 and following, we looked at that. And that's reiterated, clearly reaffirmed in the New Testament. So that is the plan, that is the practice that we're to uphold. And Sarai and Abram are willing to go outside of that practice for the sake of expediency. You know, they're willing to come up with a plan that violates God's plan. So verse 4. So Abram went into Hagar, and she conceived. Then she saw that she had conceived, so her mistress became contemptible in her sight. And I like the way Gil is how Gil said. He said, this impatient plan quickly blew up in their face. It ends up being a very bad situation. So again, Hagar, you know, the maternal pride in Hagar kind of comes forward and has this unintended consequence of, you know, Sarai becomes contemptible in the eyes of Hagar. This change in attitude, I think NASB translates that word contemptible, despised. So she's like, you know, kind of arrogant around Sarai now. So this tension is developing. So verse 5. And Sarai said to Abram, may the violence done to me be upon you. I gave my servant woman into your embrace, but she saw that she had conceived, so I became contemptible in her sight. May Yahweh judge between you and me. But Abram said to Sarai, behold, your servant woman is in your hand. Do to her what is good in your sight. So Sarai afflicted her, and she fled from her presence. Okay, so this is kind of an interesting thing. You know, Sarai blames Abram for the grief and tension that her plan caused. So it was like, she demands then that Abram do something about it. And that word violence, I think, is translated wrong in NASB. And Abram doesn't accept any responsibility. He says, it's your problem. She's in your hand. Do whatever you want. So, you know, rather than trying to resolve this issue between Hagar and Sarai, he just turns it over to Sarai and abdicates his responsibility for leadership. So basically, Hagar is returned to her status as Sarai's servant, and she's treated very poorly. Sarai chooses to make her life very difficult. He afflicts her, treats her harshly, is the idea there. And it's the same word that we have back in chapter 15, verse 13, where it talks about the mistreatment in the Egyptian bondage. That's the same word, mistreated, back in chapter 15. So again, and as a result of Sarai's poor treatment of Hagar, Hagar decides to take off. So she leaves. She fled. She ran away. And she's on a route back to Egypt. And this was just a note from one commentator that said that this kind of dispute was evidently not uncommon in this day. And there was provision in the law for settlement between a wife and her slave girl. And it's addressed in the Code of Hammurabi. I thought it was kind of interesting. Everybody knows the Code of Hammurabi, like the leader of the ancient Babylonian Empire. And the Code of Hammurabi, which you hear about a lot, apparently there's 282 laws in that code. And it deals with, I don't know, maybe you're familiar with it, Nick, the Code of Hammurabi, 282 laws dealing with justice, property, contracts, family law, and penalties. And the commentator summarized law number 145 and 146 from the Hammurabi Code. And it says, if a wife cannot bear children and gives her husband a female slave to bear children for him, that's a situation we have, the slave does not become equal to the wife. If the slave becomes arrogant because she has borne children, the wife may discipline her, though she may not sell her if she has borne the husband children. So this is all following the custom of the day. Okay, Abram turns things over to Sarai, and Sarai disciplines Hagar, but Hagar takes off. Okay, she's not going to put up with that. So then verse 7. Now the angel of the Lord, found her by a spring of water in the wilderness by the spring on the way to Shur. And he said, Hagar, Sarai's servant woman, where have you come from and where are you going? And she said, I am fleeing from the presence of my mistress Sarai. Then the angel of the Lord said to her, return to your mistress and humble yourself under her hands. So a couple things here. Sure, location's uncertain, but it's on the way from Canaan down to Egypt. And we'll be back in Shur in chapter 20 and chapter 25. But again, Hagar here is apparently fleeing back towards her native homeland, which would make sense. So she finds a spring, you know, it's a desert area. She finds a spring. That's sort of like a evidence of divine provision. Okay, God is taking care of Hagar through this process. And then we have the first appearance in Scripture of the angel of Yahweh, or the angel of the Lord, a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ, you know, appearing to Hagar in this visible form. And this appears as angel of the Lord, angel of Yahweh, appears, one commentator said, probably 65 times in the Old Testament. And what we find as we see the angel of the Lord in action is that his character and deeds and power confirm that he is deity. It's a second member of the triune God. He distinguishes himself from God, the angel of Yahweh does, but he also speaks as God in various settings. And you always think back to Exodus chapter 3, the angel of the Lord, the angel of Yahweh, appeared to Moses out of the burning bush and talks to Moses as God in Exodus chapter 3. We are going to see a couple more appearances of the angel of Yahweh in Genesis. It's going to appear to Hagar for a second time in Genesis chapter 21, when after the birth of Isaac, Sarah kicks Hagar and Ishmael out of the house, and the angel of the Lord is going to appear to Hagar again then. And then also he's going to appear to Abraham in Genesis chapter 22, when Abraham is ready to sacrifice Isaac. That's when the angel of the Lord intervenes and, okay, you've proved you're faithful to me, Abraham. Here's a goat, or here's a sacrificial animal for you to use instead of your son. So we'll study that a little more when we get into chapter 22. So this angel of Yahweh tells Hagar, gives her a command, return and submit to Sarai. You know, humble yourself under her hand, submit yourself to her authority. And verse 10, moreover, the angel of Yahweh said to her, I will greatly multiply your seed so that they will be too many to be counted. So again, we have some promises here coming to Hagar. And, you know, this is, I like how it says, you know, the angel of the Lord said to her, I will greatly multiply your seed. So this is God speaking. You know, who else can multiply seed? It's going to be God. So God here is speaking as in the form of the angel of Yahweh. And gives her a divine promise. She's also going to have many descendants, kind of similar to Abram. Hagar will have many descendants. Verse 11, and the angel of Yahweh said to her further, behold, you are with child, and you will bear a son, and you shall call his name Ishmael, because Yahweh has heard your affliction. And he will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand will be against him. And he will dwell in the face of all his brothers. NASB is different there. We'll talk about that here pretty soon. But so here we have the promise of a son, Ishmael. And Ishmael means God hears. It's a combination of the word for God and a combination of the word to hear, the verb to hear. So, and this is the first unborn child named by God. Okay, Isaac is also going to be named by God. And of course, in the New Testament, John the Baptist is named by God. And Jesus is named by God. He is God. But here we have, again, Ishmael. Ishmael will also be the recipient of divine blessings, and we'll look at that a little more in chapter 17 and chapter 21. And again, as we talked about before, he's the forefather of many nations, the Arab peoples. So, and this is, you know, great comfort to Hagar during this difficult time. You know, remind Hagar, God's giving you special attention here. He's going to take care of you. You're going to have children. There's going to be blessing in your family. And I think, too, it's one commentator pointed out, and I thought this made good sense. It's a reminder to Hagar, this is the God of Abram talking. You're fleeing back to Egypt. It's not the small g gods of Egypt that are the true and living God. It's the God of Abram that is the true and living God. And then verse 12, he will be a wild, verse 12 and 13 talk about some characteristics of Ishmael. He'll be like a wild and untamed donkey, you know, which roams the desert at will, fierce independence and love of freedom. And that would be an apt description of Arabs in the past. You know, they were wanderers and the Bedouin wanderers. So it would clearly picture those people at that time. And then his hand will be against everyone and everyone's hand will be against him. The idea of hostility and opposition and just all the warfare that's existed in that part of the world for such a long time. And he will dwell, that word dwell also translated live, in the face of all his brothers, in verse 12. And there's a little bit of controversy on that, that we're in the face of all his brothers, that word face. It's translated, I think in NIV, it's translated hostility toward his brothers. In ESV, over and against all his kinsmen, it's kind of this relational thing where there's going to be hostility between him and his brothers would be the Jews, primarily the descendants of the family, you know, descendants from Isaac. But the NASB translates this, chose to translate this a little bit different. So if you're using a New American Standard, instead of translating this relationally, this is how, you know, Ishmael is going to interact with his rest of his, the family, they translate it geographically. So I think that NASB says that he will live to the east of all his brothers rather than in conflict with all his brothers. And it's just either translation is legitimate. And we do find out later on in Genesis 25 that Ishmael does indeed live east of his brothers. So it's a fine translation. But I was looking through about 20 different translations, and NASB is the only one that translates it east of his brothers. The others all translate it in the context of how he relates with his brothers. It actually, kind of one caveat to that, in the New King James Version, they do translate it in the presence of his brothers. So that's maybe more geographical than relational. So again, just kind of how it's chosen, it doesn't change the point at all. The point is there's going to be hostility resulting from, after Ishmael is born, in hostility with the descendants of Isaac. Okay, so another thing too, we kind of note the similarities here. You know, God's provision for Hagar and Ishmael are going to have similarities to his provision for Abram and his descendants, but they lack the force of the covenant that's been made with Abram. Okay, verse 13. Then she called the name of Yahweh who spoke to her, "You are a God who sees." For she said, "Have I even remained alive here after seeing him?" Therefore, the well was called Be'er Lahairoi. Behold, it is between Kadesh and Bered. So Hagar responds to this revelation from God in faith. You know, again, she clearly sees this angel of Yahweh, the angel of the Lord, as God himself. Okay, so that's the way that the Bible teaches this. So Hagar speaks now to Yahweh. You know, you're the God who sees, El Roy. She's fully aware. He's fully aware of her situation and plight. And then she marvels, this is the true and living God. And I've seen him and I'm still alive. Excuse me. So she's amazed that she's been able to see him and still live through the process. And then that the name of that well, Be'er Lahairoi, it's a combination of three different words. It's a combination of the word for well or spring, and the word for alive or living, and the word to see. So again, aspects of Yahweh, of God there. It's literally the well of the living one who sees me is the name given to this site. And again, it directly reflects Hagar's confession in verse 13. You know, you are a God who sees. I'm at this well and you see me and you are alive. And that's the name of Be'er Lahairoi reflects that truth. And so I think here we really have a conversion experience with Hagar. It seems like she's understands that this is the true and living God who is watching over her and taking care of her and has revealed himself to her. So, and that Beer Lahairoi, we'll see Abraham visiting there in chapter 24, and it does become Isaac's dwelling place in chapter 25. So we'll be seeing that site show up again. In the end of verse 14, another geographical note, it's between Kadesh and Bered. It's the only time that Bered is mentioned, so we don't know where it is. Some have identified it with a site 12 miles south from Beersheba. Beersheba is one of those sites that we know where it exists in southern Canaan. And Bered is 12 miles from there, maybe. But Kadesh, Kadesh is going to show up a number of times in the Old Testament, and it's 50 miles south of Beersheba. So again, this is all key here is that we're going south to Egypt was the thing. Kadesh, more fully, Kadesh Barnea, very infamous site in the days of Moses. That's where the spies give the bad report, and Israel doesn't go into Canaan like they were supposed to. And God in judgment, nobody under 20 gets to go in to the land of Canaan, except for Caleb and Joshua. And guess what? You get to wander for 40 years in the wilderness, in the desert. So that's the same site. So it's probably about 50 miles south of Beersheba. So verse 15, so Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram called the name of his son who Hagar bore Ishmael. Now Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to him. So again here, Hagar's obedient, apparently returns, willingly submits to Sarai's authority, probably tells Abram exactly what transpired, and then Abram consents to name the child of what the angel of the Lord had instructed them to name the child, Ishmael. That was kind of interesting. One commentator pointed out that here we have this Egyptian slave coming back after this experience, bringing the message that Abram should have known from the beginning. Okay, it's should bring this message that God sees and hears. We need to trust him. We need to live by faith is the message that Hagar brought back. And Abram consents and follows through and is faithful from that time on. And then kind of verse 16, the time marker. 11 years have passed since Genesis chapter 12 when Abram was 75 years old when he came to Canaan. So had a little over a decade transpire here. Still another 14 years before Isaac is born. So they still have to live in this, this uncertainty about when and where this heir is going to be born to Isaac and Abram. So, and when Isaac is born in chapter 21, Abram's going to be 100 years old and Sarai's going to be 90. So, and then kind of something that hit me as I was going through this, just a couple of key lessons. Human attempts to help God out are misplaced, especially when they embrace things that aren't consistent with biblical truth. We don't need to help God out. He's made promises. He's carrying forward with his plan, and he's going to do it in his perfect timing. He doesn't need us to violate our conscience, violate the word of God to help him out. That always results in disaster. And also, God hears the cries of the afflicted to turn to him in faith. Poor Hagar, lowly Hagar. Guess what? She's the first one that we're told that the angel of Yahweh appeared to her, to this lowly slave woman, on her fleeing back to Egypt in the middle of the desert. There's not even any water. Gives her water and then tells her, this is what you need to do. So he hears the cries of the afflicted who turn to him in faith. And then also, too, I think a blessing that we want to pick up out of this is God works outside the line of blessing. Ishmael was not in the line of blessing, but he's going to have divine promises. Guess what? We're not Jews either. We're not descendants of, I don't think of any, well, maybe there's one in here, but we're not descendants of Isaac. We're not in the promised line, but yet we benefit from the Jewish Messiah who will be born 2,000 years after this. And I liked the John chapter 4, verse 22 came to my mind. And there's a Samaritan woman at the well. What does Jesus say? know, salvation is from the Jews. Okay, a lot of people don't like that. You know, that's why there's so much anti-Semitism. But salvation comes through the Jews. It's not exclusively a truth that only applies to the Jews. Our salvation comes through a Jewish Messiah, through the line of Abraham and Isaac. So, you know, like it or not, that's God's plan. So we'll go ahead and stop there. Again, next week, no class. We'll have the Pancake Palooza. And then 2 weeks, we'll go ahead and go through chapter 17. So I think there's a couple of minutes. If anybody has any observations or comments. I think last week we talked a little bit about Amorites and Ammonites, but those were different. I had to go back and look at that just to clarify it in my own mind. The Ammonites will be the descendants of Lot, and we'll see that later on. And the Amorites, though, pre-existed that. The Amorites are identified back in the Table of Nations in Genesis chapter 10. So if that was confusing anybody, I wanted to clarify that. So any other questions or comments?